All right, let's go to their questions from the audience. Do you think the stock market is a bubble, and is it likely to have a serious drop? Chris, you went through this in 2008.
Yeah.
Do you see any signs that that we could have the same problem with regards to
not the same problem.
The market?
Not the same problem, because someone passed a bill called the Dodd-Frank legislation. There's always a danger of that. I mean, but I think it's less an indication. I think obviously the Fed's going to raise rates. They've been doing that, slowing things down a bit. You're seeing some of that reaction you've mentioned here in the last couple of weeks. But I'm not prepared to say, nor would I know necessarily whether or not this constitutes to be a bubble, as we know, such as the housing bubble or the dot-com bubble that we went through here. I think a lot of this is what I mentioned earlier. I think it's a lot of confidence that people have, certainly renewed confidence after having been through what we did as a result of the recession. And people have been feeling better about how things are working. There's a cautionary note I mentioned already on whether or not that good feeling is going to be around long enough to sustain this. But I think what's happened recently is people feeling far more optimistic about how things are moving. And I think that's reflected in the stock market.
Kelly?
You know, obviously we saw the recent adjustment, so to speak. So I will not try to pretend that I'm an expert on what's going to happen in the stock market. I think the two biggest issues, though, that we need to keep an eye on are rising interest rates and inflation. So, I mean, those are the issues with the Fed having kept the rates so low for so long, and with our economy, obviously, doing well in terms of the unemployment rate. So those, I think, are, and I do not pretend to be an economic expert, but I believe that those are really the issues that we need to focus on and be aware of. And I also would say that part of the reflection of what's happened in the market is a sense of, you know, some of the regulatory reform that's been done, and also the tax reform in part was kind of built in some of the exuberance in the market also, because many of our companies who did have a lot of money parked overseas and felt that we weren't competitive, you see that like a company, for example, like Boeing, who's booming on the market right now. I mean, that bill, I can tell you, has a big impact on a company like that.
It could be the news too, Lynn, just to ask you, as a Democrat, there's been a lot of criticism about appointees that the Trump administration has made. Jay Powell's appointment to replace Janet Yellen was a very strong and good appointment as chairman of the Fed. I have a lot of confidence he can do a good job.
Well respected on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, very good.
Okay. Turn to immigration, which is a big part of our economy. Immigrants are the core of four major industries in the U.S. One of those industries, agriculture in this area, has a huge market in terms of exports. We have the hospitality industry as well in this area, which depends a great deal on those workers. We know the controversies that are there. What do you think is the bipartisan solution to formulate a more accepting policy change when it comes to immigration? Kelly?
Thanks for the easy questions. I mean, this issue is the ultimate Washington football, right? And the politics of this are not easy in terms of the right and the left. I supported the bipartisan immigration bill when I was in the Senate. I think that we have a system that is broken on the legal immigration front and has some serious flaws on the illegal immigration front, too. And so you have to have the combination of both. If you're looking at a bill, you know, it's going to have a bill that's going to have enforcement of law and security pieces, many of which the president has supported, whether it's a virtual wall or actual wall, depending on where you are in the border, and enforcement of the laws. But let's face it, our legal immigration system, we're a country of immigrants. We know that probably many of our businesses can't fill the positions that they have now. We have people that come here and go to our best education institutions that we should keep here to help us grow our economy. But at every level, education level, we We need the vibrancy of people who want to come here, be part of our nation, who want to work, and who want to contribute to our nation. That does make us stronger. But our system is totally broken down. People who wait a decade, who are trying to do the right thing and go through the right form, you know, they can't become a citizen. And then, you know, you have people who are here illegally, who, if, by the way, if I'm someone who's not a fan of sanctuary cities at all, I think we should enforce our laws. So if you break the law, whether you're an American, I just think it's pretty straightforward. If you're an American or you're an illegal immigrant and you break our law, people should cooperate and hold people accountable. So those are areas, if you put that combination together, the bill has already kind of been worked on in Washington. We know what the components are. It's just a matter of people having the political courage to say, I'm not going to use this as a political weapon any further. I'm actually going to work on a bipartisan bill and come up with something that makes sense for this nation.
Chris?
Well, again, I agree with Kelly. It's a complicated issue over the years. It fascinates me, given the fact that we all recognize, they suspect 95% of us in this room, or maybe more, are all children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren of immigrants. And we all recognize, without any hesitation, that one of the greatest assets was not because we happened to be in a great climate zone for us to do well. We did something no other nation ever did in the world, and that is we welcomed some not as warmly as others, who decided to call this place their home. And as a result, we've grown and been successful because of that diversity in our population. But to listen to some of the debate and conversation, there's almost a denial of the fact that we've benefited tremendously from this. I also find it somewhat ironic. I remember not long ago when I was still in Congress having a town hall meeting in Connecticut. And the subject of immigration came up by an individual who had a brogue, an Irish brogue, so thick you could cut it with a meat axe, wondering when the hell are we going to close the doors and stop this crowd coming into the United States. And I when did you arrive here? You know, about an hour ago. And so it's always sort of stunned me. I mean, it's in a way how it can fire up the anger of people when we start talking about immigration. One out of four Americans are either immigrants themselves or the children of first-generation immigrants, a quarter of our population. 40 million Americans arrived here as immigrants in the country. An additional 40, one parent of them was an immigrant. That's 80 million of us. So it's close. I go back, my parents or grandparents came in the 1820s, 1830s from Ireland, left and came to this country. So it ought not to be the understanding of how we do this. We can't have open borders, obviously. I don't object necessarily to, I agree with Kelly, whether it's actual or real, building some kind of a wall if you have to, but you got to cooperate with people. We have 1 million people that go back and forth on the border between Mexico and the United States every day. 1 million people back and forth every day. We have an engagement with Canada every day. I forget the numbers, but they're in the hundreds of thousands of people who go back and forth and work in our two countries. We've got to have some sort of cooperation if this is going to work, in my view. And obviously, to try and fix things. I get uneasy a little bit about a merit-based system because I can see that just being ripe for the kind of abuses that can happen. We take a chance sometimes in a lottery. It's not perfect, but to the extent it's easier by that than necessarily deciding that someone has a college degree, someone has a high school degree, which is the one you take. In many cases, the people with little to no education that come can make a significant contribution and a chance to be here. So, again, I'm not obviously out of politics today, as we both are, but it always has mystified me why people couldn't find out a solution on this that would work for the country. And I think we're better off in the long term doing it. There are a lot of very talented, good people in our nation. I worry about the so-called dreamer population. I don't know how you take a child that came here as an infant and decide all of a sudden they're going back to where they're from. I mean, I remember in Connecticut, I had a child in Norwich, Connecticut. She was the valedictorian of the Norwich Free Academy. And she went to fill out applications for college and discovered she was illegal. And was about to be sent back to Haiti. Believe me, there's no way in the world this child was going to survive back in Haiti anymore. She was 4 months old when she came here. And there are case after case of that as well. So we ought to be able to figure this stuff out. We ought not to be sending a lot of kids off.
Let me ask you both something. If you were back in the Senate, President Trump has talked about the wall.
Right.
when he talked about the wall during the campaign, he said, you know, I want to build a wall, but Mexico's going to pay for it.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're beyond that now. and so he's talking about asking for about $25 billion for building the wall.
Yeah.
If you were in the Senate and you were able to vote on a proposal that provided $25 billion for the wall in exchange for fixing DACA, the Dreamers situation, would you vote for that?
I'd do it in a New York minute. Get it done.
Kelly?
That's what it takes to get it done. Stop this mindless debate. Kelly's right. It's a stupid debate. If that's the deal, you put move on to the other set of issues. It seems to me it makes some sense to do it. I do that.
I'd also like them to look at the broader legal immigration system. I think there. I mean, yes, the DACA issue is obvious in the sense that it's just we can't send people who were here as kids back, and there seems to be broad bipartisanship agreement. But we also have, you know, broader issues within the legal system that I'd like to include. And by the way, I think I already voted for the wall in this sense. Just so you know, the bipartisan bill that passed the Senate, I don't even know, I was there, it was 2000, maybe 12, 13, and I voted for it, and this is what was in it. It doubled the amount of border fencing, it doubled the amount of guards, it increased the resources for drones and technology. It was very, very strict, and it pretty much was a wall. Parts of it literal, parts of it technology based on the terrain of the border,
wall.
Virtual wall. And the interesting thing is, I'm curious, because there were actually quite a few senators on both sides of the aisle that voted for it. And so something like that, you know, with fixing the legal system is, I would think, a bill that would make sense and we could get some support around it.
Can I mention something? We haven't talked about this issue. And again, I spent a lot of time. I chaired the interparliamentary meeting with Mexico for 26 straight years with our counterparts in the Mexican parliament. I don't expect most people to follow this very carefully. I don't need to probably convince you that this debate we're having in President Trump's decision that Mexico was going to build the wall for us or pay for it has made us a little less than popular in Mexico. You've got an election coming up in a few months in Mexico, a very important election. They're all important, but particularly important. Donald Trump is becoming virtually the campaign manager for a candidate, the former mayor of Mexico City, Mr. Obrador, who's more than just center-left, he's very far-left in Mexican politics. Right now, he's leading the election down there. Because, frankly, we've basically given him a great boost out of the campaign trail as a result of some of this rhetoric. There are implications to these policies. We don't live on an island on ourselves. And if people think that's going to be a better result for us, to have a neighbor to our south who is very hostile to our interests here, then we're going to look back and wonder whether or not this made as much sense. I hope people begin to think about some of the implications. Everything we do, most of us who traveled at all, in the country, everything that happens in this country is leading news in most places around the world. They follow what we do in this country very closely. And right now, it appears as though we have a very hostile attitude about Mexico and about Mexicans generally. This state and our country have benefited tremendously. The woman taking care of my room this morning, Sonia, is from El Salvador. She came here to get away from the fear she'd been going through in that country. We sometimes just forget how lucky we are that people have decided to come here and try and be a part of our country. And we can't alienate a good part of the world to come to this country.
Let me ask about this question on trade, too, because we are living in a global world.
Yeah.
This is a world that is now interconnected in terms of communications, securities, trade. Lots of trade. The United States has major trading with exports going to the rest of the world. We've obviously developed a number of agreements. President Trump ran on the basis that those agreements weren't always the best and cost us a lot of jobs. So as a result of that, tore up TTP, the agreement that was worked out for Asia. NAFTA is now being renegotiated. China, we're probably looking at increased tariffs on goods coming from China. We live in a global world. How do you reconcile a protectionist trade policy in a global world? Doesn't that allow China and others to basically fill that vacuum? Kelly?
Well, we were just talking about Mexico, and I think one of the things that is a huge issue on the plate right now is the renegotiation of NAFTA. And I can tell you that if we were suddenly to pull out of NAFTA, the impact, just given the fact that the way companies in the U.S. have configured business with Mexico as a result of NAFTA, that just doesn't change tomorrow. And it would be a huge disruption to our economy if suddenly we decided that we're going to rip it up, as opposed to renegotiate where all the countries who are involved are at the table. So that is a huge issue to keep our eye on in terms of it can have a very big economic impact on this country. Here's where I'm with President Trump on, and that is, you know, there have been times when, for example, the Chinese, it's not been reciprocal, where in fact they're selling stuff to us without the same barriers that they're not letting us sell to their markets the same. So that's a fair point. That's a fair point that, you know, when it comes to negotiating, we should have negotiations of equality. I mean, I think we would want that as a country, and we should try to demand that in our negotiations. So that's a legitimate point. You know, the issue, though, also is that we can't ignore that we are part of a global economy. In New Hampshire, my own state, we've had a tremendous impact on exports, even our smallest businesses. And if that were suddenly disrupted, and we were given less access to some of these markets, it would actually have a negative impact on our economy. So we can't go back to the days where we think it's going to be Fortress America, because that's not going to work for our economy, because, what is it, 99% of the consumers don't live here, right? They live elsewhere. And by the way, we're really good at making things, and we're pretty clever people. And so we want to be able to sell what we make and also our ideas, Silicon Valley, all the brilliant ideas we have in this country, sell them elsewhere. So we need access to those markets to be able to do it. If what he means is I'm going to negotiate in fairness where there's equality, I'd be fine with that, and I would agree with him on that. But this idea that we're going to suddenly withdraw from the world, that's not going to work for us, and that will have a negative impact on our economy, because we are all interconnected, whether we like it or not, and it's only going to continue. As we develop more technology, we're going to be even more interconnected in the 21st century.
Chris?
Yeah, no, I was a strong supporter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, not in the Senate, but as someone outside watching it. And at the time, I don't know if they mentioned this in the introduction, but for 7 years after I left the Senate, I was the head of the Motion Picture Association of America. People have asked me what the comparisons are between the Senate and the motion picture business. I forget where I am this evening in California, but I said I left one group of bad actors for another group of bad actors. But the film industry, 72%, 75% of the film business in this country depends upon a foreign market, in a sense. And China is becoming, will this year, next year, the single largest market for U.S. film in the world. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, 12 countries along the Pacific Rim, very important. We've walked away from it. We've killed it. There's another agreement that's now emerged called the Asian Infrastructure Bank that the Chinese have started. Only two countries don't belong to it now, Japan and ourselves. By stepping away from these things, aside from the economic values, and trading agreements are complicated agreements. It's never just one for one, exactly. There's not pure parity. But by retreating from these agreements, you're leaving our allies, in many cases, few alternatives. They would have preferred to deal with us, I think, generally speaking, maybe exceptions to that, but generally the case. But they have to trade with somebody. And the Chinese are filling the void in the Pacific Rim. The idea that President Obama had of pivoting a bit away from sort of a Western Europe emphasis to an Asian Pacific region, I think made all the sense in the world in many ways. We are now walking away from that, and dangerously so, in my view. The Chinese are aggressive as they can be in Africa and Latin America on purchasing natural resources, literally gaining incredible footholds, and not just in terms of commerce, but also militarily as well, and posing some major, major concerns for us. So I emphasize, Kelly's made a very good point. Obviously, you can't survive economically in this country by assuming we can only produce agriculture for our own consumption or manufacture goods only for our own consumption. We wouldn't last 6 months. But we're losing ground in the 21st century in terms of our ability to enter these markets. Trans-Pacific Partnership was far from perfect, in my view. But the absence of having any agreement is more dangerous. Now, bilateral agreements you can do, but they're much more difficult and they're slow. So,
well, one point I think that needs to be made, though, too, is that the American people are turning away from trade. I mean, look at where the presidential campaigns were. Not only President Trump, but Secretary Hillary Clinton were against the TPP. And that's not an accident. I mean, I was on the campaign trail at the same time. Trust me, there was not support from average Americans, and they aren't seeing what they understand to be the value of these agreements. And so that's where, you know, both sides really, either we better make sure that we understand what we're negotiating, that we do have the value and for America, and then also there's this connection, I think, of the people who are being left behind because they don't have the education and training. And, you know, it's blaming that the job was lost overseas. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But we aren't giving people the retraining, the tools that they need. And the American people are saying on both sides of the aisle, hey, we're worried that this isn't being fair for us. And so I think that the elected leaders need to listen to that and understand that, yes, the global economy is important, but how do we make sure that we aren't leaving people behind?
Chris, this question is to you, and it's kind of asking, what are your biggest takeaways from your role on the Senate Banking Committee and obviously the work on Dodd-Frank? It's almost 10 years since we've been through the 2008 collapse. It brought the banking industry to its knees. As a result, and raised a lot of concerns at the time that we might not be able to survive, yeah. But we did. You passed Dodd-Frank to try to better regulate the banking industry and do other consumer protection steps. We've now reached a point where at least the Republicans in the House have voted to repeal a lot of what's in Dodd-Frank, although the Senate doesn't seem to be following that lead. Give me your sense of the effectiveness of Dodd-Frank and whether today you would change anything in Dodd-Frank.
Well, first off, understanding, again, I've often say we're blessed we're blessed and burdened with no memory. And we've been, in a sense, we forget very quickly what's happened. It's amazing to me that people have forgotten what it was like 10 years ago this year. I remember St. Patrick's Day weekend in 2007 when Bear Stearns basically collapsed. It wasn't widely reported, but I'm not exaggerating when I tell you this. On that Sunday night of that weekend, when Jamie Dimon stepped in and all of a sudden picked up and bought Bear Stearns, we came within 10 minutes that evening of declaring the following day a bank holiday, which would have been the first time since the Great Depression. That's how close things were, in a sense. And he got an incredible price for Bear Stearns that day. People thought it was one-off and no problems. Let me just take you to the night of September 18th, 2008, when Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke asked for us to meet with a joint member of leadership, Democrats and Republicans, in the Speaker's office in the House side of the Capitol. And as long as I will live, seared in my memory, it will be the following line, I'll quote it verbatim for you, from Ben Bernanke that night. Unless you act in a matter of days, the entire financial system of this country and a good part of the world will melt down. That was the chairman of the Federal Reserve, the single most important banker in the globe, if you will, telling a closed-door meeting of 15 members of Congress, that's how close we were to that kind of trouble. over the next number of days and so forth, this for putting together the TARP legislation. I'm sure probably the single most unpopular thing I did in 36 years in Congress, and maybe the most important thing I did in 36 years in Congress, because stabilizing our financial institutions was absolutely critical at that moment. We had investment banks, commercial banks, insurance companies, credit unions, all collapse, merge, disappear. Iconic industries that have been around for decades were gone. You had $13 trillion in national wealth evaporated, many of it retirement incomes of seniors in our country. 5 million homes went into foreclosure. 13 million jobs basically disappeared in the country. We're still reeling from it a bit. And so putting together a bill, you could leave it like it was. The TARP legislation passed. Things stabilized. We've actually made money off that, despite what people said at the time. And people will argue about whether or not we should have stepped in or not. I think we made the right decision to do it. And people lost their jobs. It was 40 days before a national election, and people were up for re-election, and most who voted for it who were up lost their seats in Congress and elsewhere. A moment of courage, in my view, did the right thing. The Dodd-Frank legislation, first of all, I didn't like my name on it, not because I didn't like the bill. I think it's silly to put individual names. There were dozens of people who helped put that bill together, Democrats and Republicans, by the way. And so the idea of, I don't know why it isn't financial services names, Glass-Steagall, Graham Leach, Bliley, gone along with why it was names up on those bills. You could never have passed that bill the year before we did, and you couldn't have passed it the year after. But people have been talking about crisis management and doing something about the architecture of financial services. The single word I thought of through all of this process, and it was dealing with derivatives, dealing with too big to fail, dealing with corporate governance issues. I mean, you get down a long list, very complicated. The one word I kept in there, how do we restore confidence in our financial system in this country? It's the single most important word in my view. I remember once a manager of a sovereign wealth fund said to me, I asked him why he invested so much of his country's wealth in the United States. He said, for two reasons. He said, number one, you're pretty good at making money. And so investing your money here is not a bad idea. But he said, the second reason is actually more important than the first. He said, I've never lost a wink of sleep worrying about the fairness of your financial system in the United States. I've made bad bets. I've lost money. But never because the system failed, in a sense, but began to lose confidence in our system and the fairness of it, the equity of it. And it was very important, in my view, that we could do everything possible to restore that confidence. Now, is it a perfect bill? Of course not. It's ridiculous to say that. And are there unanticipated consequences? Of course there are here. 10 years later, obviously, you have the ability of hindsight to say, where would you modify things and so forth, the Volcker Rule. I don't want to bore your audience with technicalities, but there are certain things that clearly went too far. There's always a regulatory creep, no matter what you do. You have to pull back on that where you can. There are bills pending, which I think can make some sense, provided they don't go too far. Basically, the best evidence I can offer is the banking system is in sound shape today. Bank stocks are up here. There's stability to it. We're not worried about it any longer. I'm not suggesting everything we did is responsible for that, but I think overall, the sense of confidence in our financial institutions is in better shape because of it.
Kelly, let me ask you on this issue of regulation versus deregulation. I mean, the reality is, look, there's a bipartisan support for areas of regulation in the sense of food safety, dealing with the FAA and, sure, and communications, dealing with transportation, dealing with drug safety. I mean, there are areas where, you know, the American people need to have regulation. On the other hand, we also know that regulators can be heavy-handed. How do you find that balance between regulation and, you know, and freedom in our economy?
Well, and you know, I think there's actually a lot of areas where there's bipartisan agreement that we need basic regulation for public safety. But where do we find the balance? I think there was a very especially common feeling, I can tell you, among Republicans, but I think it extended beyond Republicans, that under the Obama administration, the people that were in charge of the agencies really took the regulations to a level that had an impact on our economy, that was holding certain businesses back, even to the smallest business. And so I think one of the issues in Washington, sometimes we lurch from too much of something to too little of something. And I think that one of the adjustments we've seen is some of the regulatory adjustments that have been made have had a positive impact on the economy under the Trump administration. You know, do I agree with all of them? Not necessarily, but a bunch of them I do. You know, if you look at how much power the Department of Labor took under the Obama administration on issues that had broad impact, including, like, just one example, overtime rules on nonprofits, it was unbelievable. And I had, like, nonprofit leaders coming to me going, I can't restructure my employees. I'm not going to be able to serve my population here. I mean, it was that broad. So, you know, I think the idea is, yes, we need sensible regulation, but a lot of issues, by the way, can be handled by the states. And so you also have to ask, is the Washington the best place? Is it a national issue? Or should we allow state regulators to handle it? And that question I don't think gets asked enough in Washington because, you know, we think that we're all knowing, unfortunately, I mean collectively on both sides. And so I think that's one question too. Is there someone else who's covering it? And are they doing it effectively? And hopefully we'll ask that question as well. But in the media, I think sometimes it gets painted, well, Republicans just don't want any regulations and Democrats just want tons of regulations. And, you know, I think that there are areas where we can find a lot of common ground where, you know, we want to find that, you know, middle piece. And, you know, Chris and I bet you could sit down right now and say, okay, maybe on the small banks, it got a little heavy-handed, right? So, or are there areas that, that maybe we'd have some agreement on legislation even he's worked on, right? So it just depends, and I hope that we can find some more, you know, obviously bipartisanship around this regulatory issue. And we need to listen more to the people that are being impacted, because sometimes this thing's totally unintended, right? Sometimes you pass a regulation and the worst consequence isn't even what you were trying to regulate. It's that you really didn't know what was happening within the industry and all of the unintended things that flow from it. And we collectively don't often know because we're not experts in that area.
Let me ask you, we're in 2018, it's an election year. Obviously a lot of interest in what happens in November. But I want to ask both of you, how confident are you that the Russians will not play a role in influencing, you know, voting patterns in this country? How confident are you that we can deal with that threat? Chris?
Well, again, I'm not there, so I'm not sitting in on committees where you have a lot of this information. It's been tragic watching what's gone on with the intelligence committees and so forth. I mean, I think the Senate under Richard Burr and Mark Warner has been working pretty well. I was telling you earlier, you know you're getting older when you look at the Senate today. Mark Warner was my driver in my first race for Congress. His car only went forward. We had no reverse in the car. We had to park it going downhill each night so we could start the day. He's now running the Intelligence Committee, I tell him. But watching the House has been tragic in a way. I mean, again, there was, you know, up until fairly recently, before I arrived in the Senate in 1981, there was one committee staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. You had unified staffs, the things you were working on. The idea that now we've gone off in this, their respective camps each where has contributed, I think, significantly to things. So I suspect, based on what I've heard anyway, that and even more recently, apparently on the Winter Olympics in South Korea, the Russians were trying to blame the North Koreans for doing it, or the Russians were involved to some degree in the hacking into the Olympics in the country. So I guess there's every reason to believe they're still active, aggressively active, and doing it. What was stunning to me in a way is, I mean, it's hard to imagine, and this is probably a better question for you, Leon, than for Kelly and I, but to have, what was it, 17 or 19 intelligence agencies unanimously agree about something. I'd love to know how many times that's happened.
Not much.
Recently. Well, you've answered the question. Look at them.
Yes.
Rarely, I suspect. And the fact that there was such unanimity about this problem says volumes. The fact that the President Trump still wouldn't refuse to acknowledge was stunning to me. And I still to this day don't understand why. I mean, entirely, he would contradict or try to contradict overwhelming evidence from his intelligence offices. And so I am worried about it. I wish we would do, something else, though. I don't get a sense. We're living in a world where hacking is going to be with us, whether it's the North Koreans, the Russians, or anyone else for that matter. Are we really doing enough to make us secure? And I don't hear a lot of talk about that. I hear a lot of talk spent on going after who's doing it, but not how to stop
it. Let me ask Kelly on that question. What do you think?
Yeah, when I look at what I see happening, and you know, the Russians weren't just trying to muck with our elections. And by the way, to try to undermine our democratic institutions. And they've tried to do this in France. They've tried to do this in other countries in Europe. They try to, we're not alone with this, okay? And I think what's being missed in Washington is that there's so much focus on the Mueller investigation that there doesn't appear to be a big movement on the bigger picture of, okay, what are we going to do to protect ourselves so no matter what party, it doesn't happen again, and that we're prepared, we know what tricks they have up their sleeves, and that we're going to stop those tricks. And that's beyond the Mueller investigation. That's about something that we just all should care about, to me.
We're at the end of our period here, but I just want to say to all of you that, you know, we've talked about the issues affecting the American dream, and there are issues that affect all of us. And I hope that ultimately, by virtue of our democracy and our faith in our democracy, that ultimately we'll continue to make sure that our children can enjoy the American dream, because ultimately that is what America is all about. Thank you for coming tonight. Thank our speakers.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, enjoyed it.